This lecture is titled Decline, Fall, and the Options, and you'll see why. The great Southern novelist of the 20th century, Walker Percy. We have any Walker Percy fans here? Wow. People need to read Walker Percy. He's awesome. he was once asked what his thesis was, and he said he didn't want to speak about any one thesis, but that generally speaking, he was interested in decline, fall, and the options. I share his interest and owe the title of this lecture to him, Decline, Fall, and the Options. I suppose we should all be interested in the question of decline and fall. It has been the fate of many, virtually all, great civilizations, including those that thought they would go on forever. The late Dr. Percy had a nice line about that. He used to ask, "When's the last time you saw a Hittite walking around New York City?" The question is meant to provoke you into thinking about what kind of ancient personage you might actually encounter in the Big Apple. And of course, what's the answer to that question? The Jews. The Jews. But even they, though managing to survive tremendous adversity, have had their kingdoms fall. Their survival and continuity with their own past, basically unparalleled, is powerfully suggestive of both the providence of God in preserving a people he claimed as his own and of the legitimacy of the Hebrew Scriptures. In the last lecture, I talked about two revolutions. A revolution that included a positive Christian influence, which was the American Revolution, and a revolution that was secularizing, which was the French Revolution, which has had many successors in the modern world. And I noted that the two revolutions produced radically different results, as the American version led to a flowering of freedom and democracy, whereas the French effort ended in dictatorship, the rise of Napoleon, and an unstable political future for France, which did not really firm up until late in the 20th century when Charles de Gaulle was able to name his conditions for taking power and preventing a coup d'etat. I went on to argue that there were a number of ways in which Christianity has been productive of the rights and freedoms that we enjoy today. But even if one accepts my argument, a few questions remain. So what if Christianity was important in getting us to where we are today? We are where we are. Why is Christianity important now? We don't have a general agreement about religion. Why can't we just be happy for the good result that Christianity has given us while simultaneously bidding it farewell, at least as a community, because we are now suitably evolved so that we do not need it. We have the rights and freedoms that we have, and how we got them or what was responsible for it isn't all that important. My first answer to the question of why Christianity is still important, and one I will dwell upon in the next lecture, is the same one Diogenes Allen once gave to a fellow professor when asked why he attended church. "Because Christianity is true," he said. More on that in the third lecture. But leaving that aside, and I know it sounds odd to say, let's leave aside that we think Christianity is true. We do that sort of thing when we're making an argument. I want to return to the metaphor I used at the end of the last lecture, which is the cut flower civilization metaphor. I said that the sources of our way of life are important. The sources. And Elton Trueblood talked about the cut flower. So to restate it briefly, the flower of civilization, things like rights, freedoms, and cultural institutions, will wither and die and decay once separated from the sources, which are Jewish, Christian, and classical. I think the most powerful source of Western civilization is Christianity. Do not forget that while the Roman Empire fell, the church never did. The church remained. It was the carrier of civilization, and it cannot be discarded without consequence so easily as many believe. As I was preparing for this lecture, I happened across a blog item where a young man was angrily and incredulously criticizing the idea of cut flower civilization. He was very much ready to be done with Christianity and could not understand why anyone would believe amputating it from our culture would have any negative results. His question, in paraphrase, was, do those fools actually believe that thousands of years of civilization can be swept away so quickly just because they leave religion behind? The answer is that I do believe that. I do believe that our rights, values, and freedoms are in danger at any given time, and I think that both reason and evidence are on my side. In the first lecture, I noted the extraordinary death toll and loss of freedom due to high-minded political movements like the French, Russian, Chinese, and Cuban revolutions. Efforts intended to set men free and to bring about paradise led to dictatorship and extreme political repression. It is no accident that in each case, religious objections, religious obstacles were brutally and systematically removed by the paradise makers. The revolutionaries did not want to tolerate any competing vision of the church. They wanted more than the people, they wanted their souls as well. Remember Rousseau, again from the first lecture. His problem with Christianity was that it provided a choice of masters. A good state, in his view, should have only one master. And that master is the state, not the church. And when that happens, when there is only the state and the individual, and nothing else in between, state power in the hands of an elite becomes the decider of who would have what rights and freedoms. If attempts to reform society without God's help help us reach the point where brute power wielded by a few rules the fate of men and women, then civilization has not advanced, it has regressed. The bottom is much lower than those of us living in free countries think it is. None of us want to live under a regime of arbitrary power. Whatever Michael Moore may think of it, Cuba, for example, is an objectively bad place to live. Each one of these revolutions is a powerful example of True Blood's characterization being verified in dramatic and empirical fashion. There's something else worth noting before I begin to develop a couple of ideas in a more structured way. Many Christian scholars have noticed the pains that their non-Christian counterparts take to attribute the best features of our civilization to the classical world. In other words, there is a desire to say that Greece and Rome gave us the most important values, rights, and freedoms that we enjoy today. What these scholars forget is that the Greco-Roman world, for all its erudition and accomplishment, was a cruel one. Human life was held in low esteem. There are many ways to measure this claim, whether it be through the easy acceptance of abortion and flat-out infanticide, the gladiatorial games, or the practice of slavery. The reader of political philosophy is often shocked to sail along with the greatness of Plato, only to run aground on his endorsement of eugenics, or to thrill at the wisdom and genius of Aristotle, only to shudder a bit as he easily embraces the enslavement of other human beings as the rightful design of nature. Compare those two to Augustine, the great church father, who forcefully proclaimed that men only dominate other men because of the sin of pride. Reasoning from Genesis, Augustine said that men were created as shepherds, not as kings. They should rule over the beasts, but not over other bearers of the image of God. The point I'm trying to make is that there is no easy leap from classical civilization to our own. Christianity modified the classical world in many important ways. The Muslims, as an example, also had recourse to classical texts. In fact, they had more of many classical texts than were had in Western Europe. They had the Aristotle, for instance. It was only in the Crusades that we began to recover much of the Aristotle. And one need only make a cursory examination to see that their path has been massively divergent from our own, not only in terms of rights and freedoms, but also in areas like scientific progress and economic development. In connection with what I've just discussed, I recommend two books by Rodney Stark, For the Glory of God and The Victory of Reason. He has developed a very powerful and in many cases empirical argument for the indispensability of Christianity to Western civilization. And by the way, if it's still in vogue for young Christians to apologize for the Crusades, sort of a dubious thing to do in the first place since it wasn't our blood in question, I also recommend his book, God's Battalions, as sort of a balancing agent. Houston Baptist University recently hosted the great literary scholar David Lyle Jeffrey, just a man of incredible learning. He too argued for the critical importance of Christianity and the Bible in the development of the humane tradition of the West, and is aware of the attempt by some to give credit only to the classical world. He noted in haunting fashion that the German gymnasium, something akin to our preparatory schools of the early to mid 20th century, featured a curriculum filled with the old Greco-Roman influences to the exclusion of the Christian tradition. Such a curriculum, Jeffrey said, could and did produce real Nazis. So yes, I would suggest to the outraged young blogger that the cut flower civilization metaphor offered by D. Elton Trueblood has some relevance and some currency. We can lose a lot of progress very quickly. This is a fact, not a supposition. Indeed, if you want to understand just how important Christianity is to civilization, consider the aftermath of World War II. The Nazis, of course, had done terrible things. Most notably, they carried out a program of genocide against the Jews. At Nuremberg, the Allies tried the Nazis for a number of crimes, including the Holocaust. These atrocities were referred to as crimes against humanity. The defense offered by the Nazis was actually pretty good, a very good defense in the middle of the 20th century. They said they were simply following the laws of their country, which was a sovereign nation. How can it be a crime to follow the law? If the law is simply an instrument of social regulation, without moral significance, as Oliver Wendell Holmes, a hallowed secularist justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, would have preferred it, then on what basis could the Nazis be tried? But there was something in us as human beings, and particularly as human beings who have come of age in a civilization profoundly influenced by Christianity, that found the German answer completely unsatisfying. Instead of winning their freedom, the Nazis who argued in this fashion typically died dangling on a rope that was too short to reach the ground. The trials at Nuremberg are a clear indication to me that the West got a good long look at a brave new world emerging free from the restraints of the Christian moral frame, and the West flinched. These acts had to be condemned, and they were condemned, I believe, by a distinctively Christian standpoint. One of the great sins that has been committed repeatedly by human beings is to justify violence, theft, and other atrocities against their peers by dehumanizing them. For example, the old Germanic tribes knew that they shouldn't steal from each other, but they thought it was okay to steal from those outside the tribe. They were somehow less human. The same would be true of the African slave traders, who stacked people like cordwood for sale and transported them under horrible and inhumane conditions and then sold them like cattle. The same is true of the practice of abortion and eugenics. Terrible acts become acceptable by taking away the status of personhood of the victims. When the Allies held the Nazis accountable for acts of genocide, they moved away from fashionable legal realism and moral positivism and toward a Christian view of man as a creature uniquely deserving of respect and possessing inherent dignity. There is really, I think, no other way to explain Nuremberg. If you do not embrace a Judeo-Christian view of man, then what happened in those trials was nothing more than victor's justice. How else can we blame the Germans? They were correct to say that they were just following the law. If the law is nothing more than a human invention to regulate the movement of human beings, just like the law of physics regulates the movement of atoms, then the Nazis stand essentially blameless. But none of us believes that. No one believes that. But if you can find someone who claims they do, they resemble some of the characters in C.S. Lewis's classic Out of the Silent Planet, these Earthmen without a moral compass who were referred to as being bent. The Germans knew it too. Many of them had to play language games based on denial with themselves in order to survive, to say things like how horrible it was, some of the things I had to witness in the performance of my duty. The same is often true of those who work in abortion clinics today. So I think the point is made. Much more of the life we cherish and enjoy depends on the operation of Christianity in history and culture than we tend to realize. Without it, erosion sets in quickly. But secularists tend not to be able to hear this argument. They would reject my references to secular revolutions that occurred in the past. What happened then doesn't implicate them now, they would say. I wish they would be equally forgiving toward us when it comes to something like the Inquisition, which, as I've said before, was virtually a delightful little affair compared to the atrocities committed by secular nationalists. So they want to stick Torquemada, the Grand Inquisitor, so to speak, to us with super glue, while disassociating themselves from Robespierre, Stalin, Mao, and Castro. Well, to be honest, they kind of actually like Castro. Even though we can make a strong case for the contribution of Christianity to culture, the secularizing impulse is still there. What drives it? C. John Somerville, an historian at the University of Florida, has called for a new scholarship of secularism, whereby it would be examined critically in the same way religion is examined in university religion departments. And that's part of what I'll try to achieve here in this lecture. As I think about secularism in a broad theoretical fashion, two major themes present themselves. They are two different kinds of secularism, but they are both damaging to the lives of human beings. For the first type of secularism, I will use a term that has previously been used in a mostly economic sense, but which I have adapted for a broader use. This first type I will call social leveling. For the second type, I will use a phrase understood among sociologists of religion, which is functional differentiation. Social leveling is something that we typically associate with the destruction of material differences between human beings. It is the socialist dream of a classless society in which distinctions, usually the result of economic variation, are made irrelevant. The state, empowered by the political action of the masses, or at least a group claiming to speak for the masses, works to gain control of the wealth and property of a society, and then to redistribute it in such a way as to make the people more equal. It should be obvious that this type of action vastly increases the power of the state, because it becomes the effective owner of all property. one reason it is interesting to tie socialism and secularism together under the category of social leveling is because both religion and property have been considered as the prime social flashpoints by various theorists. It has been popular for a variety of scholars and left-leaning political movements to claim that religion is the single most divisive factor in a society. However, James Madison may have been more astute when he wrote in Federalist Paper Number 10 that property has been the single greatest source of social tension and struggle between both men and nations. If you were to look deeply into the history of warfare, I suspect that Madison's case would be the easier one to support. Although socialism aims to wipe out material inequality, it may merely present a new opportunity for sin. Madison noted that taking control of the property in a state will not make people equal for more than a short time. They have different talents, abilities, and levels of energy. A new elite will assert itself, just as it has in every nation with a communist revolution. The difference is that instead of the productive computer genius earning the luxuries of life, it goes to a gifted political functionary, perhaps even to an obedient academic theorist, ready to obey. Forced economic leveling performed by the state is intended to erase the sin of greed, but it turns out that someone has to make the sacrifice of living at the mountain retreat with the on-call sushi chef. While there have been Christian socialists, socialism has primarily been the province of secularists. I suspect that is because while it is easy to understand how Christians could endorse a voluntary sharing of all property, it is harder to see them endorse the kind of involuntary sharing which a more blunt person might refer to as theft or confiscation. Political leftists often criticized Ronald Reagan for his great willingness to help individual persons who asked for his aid, while he was simultaneously opposed to erecting great structural plans of income redistribution or expansion of the welfare state. That is because he was interested in the virtue of one person helping another. Interestingly, Aristotle held the same position. He decried socialism, Plato's socialism to be specific, because it would replace the beauty of voluntary giving with a state-imposed sameness of means. Ronald Reagan knew it was right for him to sign a check and to send it to a person in need. He did not presume to do that on someone else's behalf by confiscating their funds. This also takes us back to Augustine, who realized that the presence of the official seal of state does little to make wrong actions right. The logic of social leveling can be extended in many directions. Plato applied it to property and to family. Members of his imaginary guardian class were to have both common wives, common children, common property, making sure that all of them had basically the same things was designed to create great empathy and cooperation. Thus, Plato imagined that when one felt pain, all would feel pain and would move to heal it. And when one felt pleasure, all would share the joy, and so on. There's a serious problem with this line of thinking, and it has to do with human nature. Aristotle pointed out that the man with 1,000 sons really has no son. The man with one son is almost surely willing to give his life for him. Similarly, a field that is owned by everyone is unlikely to be plowed or cared for or cultivated. A field owned by one man is quite likely to be as productive as he can make it. Starvation was a perennial problem in communist China until the communists began to yield the point and allow some private cultivation. Human beings love the particular more than they do the abstract because the particular is real to them. There is another reason why Christians are unlikely to embrace social leveling, and this is directly at the heart of what I want to get at. the logic of social leveling applies to more than property. While socialism seeks to erase the economic distinctions between human beings by taking individual choices about property out of people's hands, secularism seeks to erase the religious differences between people by making religion irrelevant to the life of the community. This action of secularism, so similar to socialism, is why I refer to it as a type of social leveling. Social leveling has a degree of appeal. The idea is that people will be made equal because equality is a goal worth striving for. The great problem in applying social leveling to property and/or economic achievement is that it takes no cognizant of merit or virtue and thus diminishes the value of both. Social leveling applied to religion may be worse because it pays no attention to the possibility of religious truth. All religious propositions are treated as utterly unprovable revelation fit primarily for the credulous. This presents a special problem for Christians who believe that their faith is really true and that there is evidence to support it in real space and time and history. One should not be surprised that secularists view Christianity as a psychological crutch. They think Christians adopt their faith for primarily emotional reasons. The power of Paul at the Areopagus, or to a lesser degree in our day of a C.S. Lewis or a Francis Schaeffer, comes from pulling the crucifixion and the resurrection into the public square and saying, "This really happened. And if it did, don't you think it is important that we figure out what it means?" Secularists refuse to entertain that question at all, to even want to talk about it, because knowledge for them connected to religion loses any potential credibility. Social leveling in the form of secularism does faithfully treat all religions the same. They become equally private, equally segregated from the life of the community. Secularists, of course, hope that religion will eventually fade away, that we'll sort of outgrow it as human beings embrace their equality with each other based on I don't know what. I'm not sure they know the answer either. If there is equality among human beings, it is equality before God, who has placed his image upon all of us. So I have argued that social leveling achieves a wrong result in the sense that it ignores things like merit and virtue in the form of socialism, and worse, it ignores the possibility of truth in the form of secularism. That alone is good reason to oppose it. But there is a bigger problem than that. The social leveling that is achieved by socialism and by secularism can only be engineered by one entity in the society. That entity is the state. Thus, the state will, as I said earlier, become the effective owner of all property. And the state will determine what manifestations of religion, if any, are acceptable to itself. If we empower the state to this degree, then the state effectively dictates reality and tends to move in the direction of totalitarianism. It is notable that the Marxist dream of human brotherhood, rooted in universal equality, stalled out repeatedly at the dictatorship stage without any probable movement toward the withering away of the state that Marx thought would eventually occur. This tendency toward dictatorship among nations opting for radical brotherhood seems to confirm the American founders' view of the human being and to disconfirm Marx's view. In other words, the suspicion of power fostered by a Christian awareness of human sinfulness is a more realistic approach. That suspicion led the American founders to build a system which makes dictatorship or the functional equivalent of it extraordinarily difficult to achieve. In a system where the state has the power to engage in social leveling, institutions which would compete with the state for influence must be minimized. So, for example, the school system is used to transmit values to children, and those values will be values dictated by the state. In this way, the influence of other institutions in the society, such as families and churches, can be blunted in favor of the state's chosen message transmitter, which is often the school. We're fortunate that we live in a society where the education function is not monopolized by the state. It is, however, highly subsidized, and alternative choices involve what amounts to a significant financial penalty. I myself am a product of public schools. But then again, I grew up like many Americans, viewing any religious enthusiasm as weird and out of step with America. In our country, there is still a healthy debate about what ought to be taught in schools, and there is freedom to participate or to withdraw. But in a social leveler state, no such choice exists. Imagine how difficult it would be to pass on ideas and information to a child in conflict with the message of the state institution that dominates his or her day. Everything in that child's life that is officially evaluated or graded would say that what the family or church believes is unimportant. Social leveling, because of the power that's needed to so radically bend and alter the organic relationships between human beings, leads naturally to totalitarianism. The logic of totalitarianism is that there are only two classes of actors in the society, the state and the individual. And the individual is expected to serve the purposes of the state. And if you read Plato, that's kind of his idea. The individual belongs to the state. This dynamic also partially explains the enthusiasm of social levelers for secularism. If the church is vital within the society, then it offers an independent voice which can compete with the state for the hearts and minds of the people. Poland offers an extraordinary example. The Poles resisted communism more effectively than many other nations, and they've recovered more quickly too, in part because its Catholic Church staunchly stood up for its rights and encouraged the people to see themselves as human beings who should be free. Karol Wojtyła, the man who would become Pope John Paul II, frequently encouraged young people to accompany him on wilderness hikes or canoeing trips to help them develop space for freedom away from the state. His underlying message, the state is not the supreme reality. There is more to life than that. A church independent of the state is freedom enhancing. By the way, how confrontational was it to the Soviets when the Catholic Church selected a Pole from behind the Iron Curtain to speak for the Church of Rome? How prophetic was that message, ringing in the ears of all who could hear it? Jacques Maritain captured this role of the church nicely when he wrote, "In the course of 20 centuries, by preaching the gospel to the nations and by standing up to the flesh and blood powers in order to defend against them the liberties of spirit, the church has taught men freedom." The 20th century was the century par excellence for social leveling. At no other time in history was there so much enthusiasm for experiments in government on a massive scale. It was the most dangerous century the world has known because it married the greatest political ambition with the greatest technological achievement. And God used that flawed former backwater of a colonial outpost, America, to blunt the apparent inevitability of scientific dictatorship across the globe. There is a second source of secularism called functional differentiation. And functional differentiation is arguably more immediately dangerous than social leveling because it happens incrementally. without the need of a revolution in order to succeed. Though it sounds like a very complicated idea, it is actually very simple. According to functional differentiation, the many different endeavors of life, things like science, business, government, art, literature, or any of a number of other pursuits, should be free from any external influences that might hinder their development. In other words, each of these activities have their own internal logic and should proceed according to that logic, with the only relevant indicator of success being effectiveness. When we say that these activities should be free from any external influence, mostly what we're talking about is religion. Religion, and mostly we mean Christianity because this is a Western idea, should not stand above the different spheres of human activity exercising the role of the conscience. It is this type of thinking to which I refer in the overall title for these lectures, "The System Has a Soul." According to functional differentiation, the system does not have a soul. It should not, and it does not have a soul. But if it does, then we would do well to kill it. My view is the reverse. The system has a soul of sorts, which is the influence of Christianity. Thank God the system has a soul, and should we succeed in killing it, the death would be a lasting source of great and paralyzing regret. Now, to be fair, functional differentiation does have a good side. For example, if effectiveness is the key criterion for evaluating an activity, then one should not discriminate between people who are interested in engaging in that activity. So access to a particular line of work should not depend on one's parentage, income level, racial background. Merit is the decider. And merit is typically a pretty good decider. But functional differentiation also has a dark side. It exiles ethics to the outside of a given activity. That is why we often treat ethics as some sort of, you know, kind of tacked on, jerry-rigged activity. We have people who serve as ethicists in business, medicine, science, and other fields, and they're supposed to offer guidelines for behavior. So in a given project, we might have a designer, a builder, a manager, and then an ethicist to tell us whether we should have done any of it in the first place. Of course, the ethicist does not act as a prohibitor or a restrainer. This person is much more likely to be a taken-for-granted permission giver or excuser. It doesn't make any sense. Human moral judgment cannot be subcontracted out and made someone else's problem because it is somehow extraneous to the actual activity. Or perhaps I should say it can be subcontracted out, but it should not be. Worse yet, we sometimes fully honor the logic of functional differentiation, and ethics don't play a part at all. So in business, we develop rules like efficient breach. Okay? This is functionally differentiated law right here for you. If efficient breach goes like this, we have a contract, okay? But then I determine by breaking the contract, I can make more money than I would by honoring the contract. As long as by breaking the contract, I could in theory compensate you for breaking the contract, then it's righteous for me to break the contract. I should break the contract, right? Am I supposed to actually compensate you? No. It's just that I could potentially compensate you. And basically what this is sort of internal legal contract reasoning to get around morality. Economic efficiency kind of becomes the guiding criterion. The only reason to honor a promise is if doing so will make you more profitable. We see the same kind of cynical strategy in litigation. One party to the suit will attempt to have it removed to a venue that is far away from the home of the other party, so that the suit will become far more expensive. Perhaps a business owner will break a contract with an employee who was scheduled to receive a promised bonus. The employee could sue and perhaps win, but can't afford the legal fees to outlast his opponent's tactics of delay. These methods avoid the entanglements of justice and win the admiration of other practitioners who recognize success when they see it. When I was in law school, I was taught that the church and the legal system were once intertwined. It was understood and appreciated that the workings of the technical rules of law might fail to yield justice. For that reason, the church had a strong role in providing courts of equity. The ancient system placed a value on justice, and the courts of equity were sort of a way to vindicate that. Fast forward to the jurisprudence of the 20th century, and you see a much greater concern with social regulation than with the substance of justice. Oliver Wendell Holmes derided the idea of any natural law. "The law is not some brooding omnipresence in the sky," he claimed. "We should banish every word of moral significance from the law," he added. Functional differentiation. This is the same man who once voted to uphold a Virginia statute requiring the sterilization of mental defectives, defined broadly, thundering that 3 generations of imbeciles is enough. And while we're on the topic of sterilization and related items, consider a more controversial area, like medical practice. Thanks to the application of functionally differentiated science in medical practice, it is possible to determine whether an unborn child is likely to have Down syndrome. Doctors perform the procedure, engage in something called genetic counseling with the parents, and about 90% of the time end up arranging for an abortion. In this way, we are solving the problem of Down syndrome. God forbid we solve other problems in this way. We could solve the problem of homelessness in this way, I suppose. I keep waiting for the discovery of a gay gene that can be detected in a similar fashion. Parents who prefer not to have 2 men visiting their home at Thanksgiving in 20 years might abort a child likely to be gay. What a terrible dilemma it will present for cutting-edge leftists when that day comes. This is the kind of thing that happens when Christianity is not meddlesomely hovering above an activity offering extraneous judgment. You decide whether this represents a civilizational advance, a payoff from taking on a more enlightened secular perspective. In Carl Stern's memorable book, The Pillar of Fire, the Jewish psychiatrist and Christian convert relates an event from the period during the war, a time in which the Nazis carried out a general execution of virtually all the mental patients in Germany. A famous Lutheran pastor, Bodelschwing, presided over a huge colony of mentally ill persons in Bethel, West Germany. This pastor fiercely resisted the killing of the patients in his care and insisted that he would be murdered with them if the event came to pass. Because of Bodelschwing's international fame, the Nazis allowed him and his inmates to survive. According to Stern, this was a kind of last-ditch stand of Christianity. Reflecting on the question of preserving lives deemed unworthy, like our unborn children who likely have Down syndrome, Stern wrote, "We cling with one hand to modern pragmatism, and with the other to the Hebrew Christian philosophy. But the gap is widening all the time. And there will be a moment when one hand will have to let go." This is the choice posed to us by the logic of functional differentiation. There are many in our society today who believe themselves to be uncommonly wise and free of the kind of mystical and, quote, unjustifiable moral logic which inhibits functional differentiation. They express outrage at those who would oppose genetic counseling of the kind I have described and criticize objectors to embryonic stem cell research for their suppression of science. What they are really doing is claiming the freedom of functional differentiation in the areas where they want that freedom. Do the same people want to see functional differentiation in business? The answer is that, of course, they do not. We could identify a large subset of citizens who would call for functional differentiation in science and then turn around and deny it for business by imposing minimum wages, trade restrictions, and affirmative action requirements. The truth is that we use functional differentiation against each other where it suits us. Few are really ready to let go of that moral sense, mostly a Christian moral sense, that continues to hover above the activities of human beings. Perhaps the best example of an activity where we should be truly happy that functional differentiation does not currently reign is warfare. The object of warfare is to defeat your enemies and to prevent them from doing you any further harm. To illustrate what I mean, let me give you an example. We have been involved in war in Iraq and Afghanistan for several years now. We gain the advantage only to lose it again. Enemies redouble their efforts, and we are hard-pressed to regain the upper hand. The whole thing seems as though it will never end. It appears as though the United States, unquestionably the greatest military power in the world, is unable to win this war. I will tell you what I tell my students. The United States could win this war anytime it wanted badly enough to do so. We have more than enough technology and raw firepower, even with conventional non-nuclear weapons, to completely destroy Afghanistan and Iraq. Those two nations could probably be wiped off the map in the course of a couple of days. The reason we do not is because we observe moral restrictions on warfare, most of which come down to us through the classical and Christian tradition of just war. This is why we use limited means. This is why we declare war before launching an attack. This is why we offer a proportionate response instead of a disproportionate one. This is why we refrain from harming non-combatants. If warfare were truly functionally differentiated, if it was just kind of purely free in its own logic, we would not stay our hand the way we do. Thank God, though, that we do. Functionally differentiated warfare, war without a meddlesome superseding morality in a technologically advanced age like ours, might be the worst thing in the world. Aristotle thought that man as a predator, the personification of armed injustice, would be the most terrible creature to walk the face of the earth. Functional differentiation, when you distill it, is essentially the rebellion of men against God. It says, we will define the good life for ourselves. It is Adam and Eve in the garden eating the fruit despite being forbidden to do so because they believed the serpent's suggestion that God might be hiding something desirable from them. I will conclude by quoting John Courtney Murray, the great Catholic scholar of church and state. He wrote presciently in the last century, "And if this country is to be overthrown from within or without, I would suggest that it will not be overthrown by communism. It will be overthrown because it will have made an impossible experiment. It will have undertaken to establish a technological order of most marvelous intricacy, which will have been constructed and will operate without relations to true political ends. And this technological order will hang, as it were, suspended over a moral confusion. And this moral confusion will itself be suspended over a spiritual vacuum." Thank you.
Hey there.
Hi again.
Good to see you again.
Yes. Fantastic lecture again, obviously. But so in reading the New Testament, especially the short period after Pentecost where, you know, it talks about almost the communist, and I'm putting that in air quotes, you know, style of living that the early church was having. Yeah. It's real easy, you know, especially when you're angry at the government or whatever, and you're a young man, to say, hey, let's aim for a Christian communist kind of state in America. I think I used to say, you know, oh, I'm a true communist at heart, you know. And then just recently, my mom picked up a book called Tortured for Christ. Have you ever heard of that?
I've read that book. That's a fantastic book.
Yeah,
Richard Wurmbrand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I kind of got slapped in the face with just, well, that's just absolutely evil. Mm-hmm. So, the communism, that is. And so, my question is, do you think it's absolutely futile to hope for a state where it is, everyone has everything in common with a dictator like Peter? Or
I don't think that maybe not until we have the reign of Christ or something like that. I don't think a temporal state can achieve these things. Now you talked about Christian communism. Communism isn't the word I'd want to use, but that the idea of Christians living together and really bearing each other's financial burdens and things like that. Obviously, I would support that. I think that's obviously a great deficit of the American church right now. I think that we have a tendency, somebody sends out something on the church prayer list, they don't know how they're going to make it, get their rent payment for next month. We'll pray for you. Well, you know what? Give them the rent payment. You know, I mean, we could be doing a lot more of that. But but the idea of giving that to the secular state, that level of power, putting that kind of coercive power in the hands of sinful human beings, I think, is a serious error.
Any other questions?
Hello.
Hi, my name is Sky. Thanks for the lecture today. I thought was really good. I found it really convincing, and it kind of, for me, raises the question, what could we do kind of at a practical level to kind of combat this kind of continuing trend towards secularism that I think still, you pointed out, still prevalent even in our culture today. You know, for those of us who maybe aren't going to go into academia even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, first mistake is asking an academic for a practical answer, but I will try anyway. Here's what I would say. You know, when I wrote the book, The End of Secularism, people always say, well, are you predicting the end of secularism? You know, that seems weird. It's everywhere. And I'm not doing that. That's one thing you'll learn, especially when you're a first-time author, is that publishers choose book titles. I think they thought that one would sell better. Part of what motivated me to write the book is that I do think that secularism is kind of philosophically spent, okay? And these things happen at sort of an academic level, and 20 years later, everybody realizes it. With the fall of a lot of these kind of, you know, secular scientific attempts at government in the 20th century, I think that you began to see sort of a degree of bankruptcy of those efforts. Postmodernism is probably a bad word at the seminary, but one of the positive impacts of postmodernism is one of the things I say in the book is that postmodernism is like the secularization of secularism. Okay, it's secularism is disappointment with Christianity in the West. Postmodernism is disappointment with secularism, and it begins to ask questions. You know, are you really objective? Are you really being fair? And I think people are starting to realize that secularism is kind of a self-interested doctrine. And so I think that there's more skepticism toward it now than there once was. And I think it, you know, at the academic level, I think we can see a degree of greater openness among many academics to Christian perspectives and Christian ideas than there were previously, when they felt much more secure in their secularism. As far as the practical way to go at it, I'll tell you what. My answer is lecture three. Lecture three is against Christian secularism. That's not the title of it, but that's the effective subject. And I'm going to talk about why Christians should not embrace secularism as many do, and what they should embrace instead. Okay? All right.
Hi, Dr.
Baker. Owen?
It is.
Oh my gosh.
How are you?
Hey.
Good.
I'm scared to death. There's no telling what you'll say.
No. I may be stealing some of the thunder from tomorrow's lectures
that's
you just
all right.
alluded to, and I don't want to do that. But sometimes Christians talk about making a case in the public square that everybody can access, and sometimes other Christians talk about basing that case in the public square on biblical truth, that sort of thing. I'd be interested to hear, and again, maybe this is tomorrow in entirety, but I'd be interested to hear what you would have to say to that. You know, just to give you a second, in terms of history, for example, the discipline of history, academic history, someone like Daryl Hart has made the case for a secular faith within the academy. I'm sure you're well familiar with that. Many people would have issues with that and would see different problems with it. I'd wonder what you have to say about the state.
Well, you're correct that this is a lot of what I'm going to talk about tomorrow, but there's something that I didn't put in the lecture tomorrow that I would like to bring up, okay? I'll give you an example of someone who argued in a very non-secular way and was very successful, okay? In the book, I talk about Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail, okay? If you haven't read that, read it. It's just short. You know, it's a few pages. But Letter from Birmingham Jail is like the cherry on top of Western political philosophy. It is a beautiful little concise summary. And he kind of mixes in this real straight up biblical witness, okay, with also kind of some Christian political philosophy. For instance, you know, not only does he talk about Nebuchadnezzar in the fiery furnace, he also talks about Augustine and Aquinas and their insistence that an unjust law is no law at all, basically a rejection of positivism. And all I can say is that the letter from Birmingham Jail had a big impact, strikes a big blow for the civil rights movement in the United States, and it's just oozing with Christianity. So for someone to come around and argue that this is somehow inaccessible, I can't understand it, I think that's just not true. I think it's not a sincere complaint. Okay. Hello.
Hi. Well, first of all, I'd just like to say that I enjoyed the way that you were denouncing sort of the secularization of a lot of government programs and things like that and actually calling taxation what it is, which is theft. But I wanted to ask you.
It's the Ron Paul revolution. Right?
I wanted to ask you. It seems like the way that we wage war today seems like a very secularly influenced thing, and we may call it just to sort of make ourselves feel better, and we may limit, you know, the number of people that are harmed, you know, while this thing takes place, but people are still being harmed. And I was just wondering, where's the line of secularism within the realm of warfare, in your mind?
Well, I mean, what I believe is what I said. I think that whether we acknowledge it or not, we are still conducting warfare in a very Christian way, particularly in the last decade or so. If you look at World War II, we started to kind of take the gloves off. In World War II, we harmed non-combatants. We did some things that don't kind of square with the Christian moral tradition, and I suppose that has to do with the level of threat, the degree to which civilization was in danger. But I'm not sure that a lot of the things that we did can be approved. For example, the bombing of Dresden, we absolutely destroyed that city and killed many, many, many innocent people. To me, that would be the secular, morally differentiated form of warfare. Okay? To the degree that warfare is restrained, I would say that's the Christian tradition. Instead, I think that restraint, these elements, I'm not sure if I can come up with all seven elements, somebody here at the seminary can, But things like the elements being that you declare warfare formally, that you exhaust all the options before committing to war, that you use proportionate means, that you don't harm combatants, these types of things, these are all part of the list of the Christian just war tradition. And I think that to the degree that the UN operates in kind of the same way, I think that the UN sort of tries to embrace a sanitized version of the Christian warfare tradition, hoping that those things will stay together without the foundation for it. Hello.
Hi. Very early in your lecture, I think you said that in this room, we all know that Christianity is true, but we tend to set that aside whenever we're making arguments.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
But then later on in the lecture, you seem to commend the postmodern critique of secularism. Mm. It seems to me like those two statements don't quite gel with one another. You think you could try to reconcile them?
You can, first of all, when I say that, leaving aside that it's true, that's because in many ways you kind of play that as the trump card, right? It's true, and so the discussion is over. But I'm trying to trace out some analysis of different types of secularism. When I commend postmodernism, I clearly do not embrace it, because certainly I believe that there is, to kind of echo Francis Schaeffer and Nancy Piercy, there is true truth, right? Legitimate truth. What I like about postmodernism is its skepticism toward the skeptics, right? I mean, it's the benefit of postmodernism without adopting it for myself is just that it seems to kind of level the playing field a little bit. It kind of takes away some of the confidence of the secularists in arguing their own cause. So I guess I'm remarking upon postmodernism in maybe kind of a sociological way instead of saying that, I imbibe of it myself.
I think it's easy for me to reject the extreme forms of any kind of social welfare, and I love the idea of meritocracy and mm-hmm. creating incentives that, produce utility in the society and all that. I love the Aristotle analogy. The harder part for me is thinking through the specific of, is there a degree of social welfare of, government wealth redistribution mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. actually does benefit the welfare of a state?
Sure.
Could you speak a little bit to that?
Sure. No, I would not entirely reject it. It's just that it's very much a matter of degree. Part of the reason it's dangerous is once you concede the principle that this is a good thing to do, it almost has kind of an irresistible logic of expansion. One of the things that we've observed way back is that government bureaucracies seem never, ever, ever, ever to go away. That growth in their entitlement, and their budget just seems to be as natural as the law of gravity. And so it's a little scary to kind of concede the logic of redistribution, because you just never know where it will end. I do think that one of the reasons that it goes as far as it does is because I don't think that we in the church have done a very good job with regard to our efforts toward the poor. One experiment that I'm a little afraid to undertake would be to examine the budgets of churches all over America and see what percentage of the budget actually goes to benevolence. I mean, it might be frighteningly low. So I think that part of the reason that we can blame the growth of the welfare state is probably our own lack of effectiveness in that regard.
Thank you very much for your presentation again.
Sure.
I was wondering, have you ever read Livy's Histories of Rome, especially like books 1 through 5?
No.
Well, okay.
But tell me about it.
Well, he has these descriptions of tribunes, which are supposed to be like the voices of the people, mm-hmm. Pandering to mobs in the forum, practically throwing bread at them, yeah. and telling them that all the rich aristocrats are trying to take away their rights. And my question was, how much does this model play into socialism with politicians and bureaucrats pandering to, well, coming up with more complex political machinery to distribute more bread to more people across a wider area. And why is this type of mob rule so antithetical to Christian liberty and the rights of the individual?
Yeah, well, I would say that, first of all, it's just a very, that sort of approach does not deal in the issue of justice. It's kind of about power and the maintenance of it, right? Plato himself is kind of disgusted with politics in his time, and he talks about the disregard for sort of wisdom and truth and justice, and so he sees these sophists as people who they specialize in teaching the public what it already knows and wants to hear, right? He just simply reaffirms their own prejudices, their own desires, tells them that they can have what they want. In fact, he compares the multitude to a monster, you know, and that there are some people who specialize in the handling and manipulation of this monster. So the degree to which something like that is undertaken just for the sake of maintaining power, obviously, you know, we would look at that as retrograde from a Christian perspective, or, you know, as Carl F. H. Henry used to say, a sub-Christian ethic, right? And I guess I would just say that's also part of the Christian suspicion of power, is that people who are given the power to do things like that are highly likely to abuse it. I mean, how often, look at Castro, how long did he stay in power? How miserable were the people in Cuba? You know, how many people spent decades in political prisons, things like that? But it was all predicated on giving people economic rights. It was all predicated on feeding them and giving them health care. But anybody, you know, so when people complain, well, Cubans have no civil rights, the response would often come back, but they have economic rights, right? Well, they may have some economic rights, like the government gives you a pair of glasses every year and, you know, you can go to some government doctor, but you have no freedom because the government entirely controls the means by which you would conduct your life. And that's not a good thing, right?